Hello and welcome to The Pioneers, brought to you in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. This series explores some of the most innovative ideas in science, technology, conservation, medicine and beyond that are making the world we live in a better place. Today we meet Dr. Kriti Karanth, the Indian scientist and founder of Wild Survey as part of the Centre for Wildlife Studies. As conservation projects in parts of India have had positive effects on boosting numbers of large mammals like tigers and elephants, they've also had a negative impact on agriculture, with crop and property damage on the rise. This has led to an increasingly fractured relationship between humans and animals. Dr. Karanth's work attempts to come up with solutions that benefit both parties. She works with governments to make sure compensation is paid faster to farmers who've had livestock eaten or land destroyed. Since 2015, her company has helped with over 10,000 claims. She also has come up with a program to teach younger generations about these animals, combating the idea of them being bad creatures. Dr. Kriti Karanth speaks to Monocle's Andrew Muller at Rolex's headquarters in Geneva to discuss the progress she's made and where she hopes to take it in the future.
We'll start with the by looking at what you're trying to address, which is conflict in India between humans and animals. How common is it?
It's very common, not just in India, but across the world. So people losing lives, getting injured, losing crops, having their houses damaged by wildlife is pretty common across the world. We've done work looking at how people address human-wildlife conflict. Do they pay compensation? How much compensation do they pay? Sweden actually pays the most compensation across the world. There are compensation programs in North America, in Africa, several parts of Asia.
This is compensation paid by the state to people who've had crops and property damaged by wildlife.
It could be paid by the state. It can also now, there's a lot of NGOs involved in dispensing compensation when there is no state mandate to do so. India is pretty unusual in the fact that there's at least 100,000 incidents of conflict reported to the Indian government every year, but the payout is about 5 million, in contrast to, say, Sweden, which probably has less than 1,000 incidents per year, but the payout is 90 million. It's because the value of compensation fixed for different kind of losses is different.
And Sweden, I guess, is a much smaller yet much richer country.
Yes. And also, I think the levels of tolerance for loss are massively different, right? People retaliate against an elephant or a tiger only when there's been a human death or a serious human injury involved. For crop loss, for loss of livestock, loss of property, there's a lot of tolerance in India still. Whereas you look at North America, Europe, one wolf, one lynx comes up and kills something that you have. There's a lot more backlash immediately in these parts of the world.
Well, in the specific instance of India, which is where a lot of your work has been based, you mentioned the likes of tigers and elephants and leopards. Is that the most common kind of interaction among those 100,000 cases reported?
So the vast majority, 90-95% is crop damage. Mm-hmm. Could be caused in certain parts of India largely by elephants, but there's pigs and there's a whole range of ungulates and different kinds of deer involved in crop damage. Livestock predation is about 3-4% of the cases claimed. And very fortunately, human injury and human death together are less than a percentage of the total number of incidents, which is remarkable given the very high densities of people and animals living in very close proximity in large parts of India.
So that brings us to the idea of Wild Survey. Where did it come from?
So I've now been a scientist for 20 years. I've particularly looked at human-wildlife conflict for the last 10, trying to understand what are the issues with conflict? What are the species involved? Is there compensation? Are people trying to mitigate through building fencing or other ways to protect their lives and property? And while we did this research across India, we went to 5,000 to 6,000 villages interviewing people about wildlife, their attitude towards wildlife, their losses from wildlife. And one thing that kind of stood out immediately for me was even in the remotest parts of India, where people didn't have electricity in their homes, everybody had a cell phone. They would ride their bicycle and or have a little solar panel and figure out a way to charge that mobile phone. And that's where the idea was came to me, where why don't we have a toll-free number that people can call in and report a conflict incident? And a lot of the frustration from the research was that, yes, India has a compensation system in place, but takes forever to file a claim. The documentation often required is so complex. It takes really long periods of time to get money back if you're lucky, or if you get anything back. And that's when I figured out, you know, if we want people to continue to tolerate these losses, as they've historically done, you need a very simple system where somebody can call in. We have a field team. We have 10 people who service 600 villages, and that's we're now scaling up to 1,000 villages, which is, you know, about 500,000 to 1,000,000 people who can call us at any point in time and say, I've had my crops destroyed by an elephant, or a leopard came and killed my goats. Please come help us. But I think the other elegance of the system is, as an NGO, we're often limited by funds. And in this case, we don't dispense the money. What we do is make sure the documentation required by the government is in place, that they're not missing certificates or they're not missing photographs. And we help them build the claim form and submit it and track the claim. But the money still comes from the government of India. So the fiscal responsibility is still, it's just improving the process itself. We've cut down processing times that used to be six months down to less than 30 days, 60 days now for certain kinds of cases.
Which, as anybody who has had pretty much any kind of experience with Indian bureaucracy will understand, is quite the accomplishment.
And I think we can do even better because the technology is there. And it's also the fact that, you know, there are many, many thousands of people who may have one incident a year or none, but there's a subset of people who call us 30, 40, 50 times a year. And we go help them 30, 40, 50 times a year. So they begin to realize, yes, we're a, you know, Center for Wildlife Studies is a wildlife conservation NGO, but they care for people as well. And they're going to enable people to tolerate their losses so that this retaliation doesn't take place or is lowered over time.
So is the, just to recap, the best way of thinking of what you've established as a kind of an intermediary between the government and the people who are trying to claim compensation from the government?
Absolutely. I think it is to improve the efficiency, increase the transparency. There used to be a lot of cash payments that were made, which meant there was leakage in the system. Now, most people who actually have bank accounts, the payments are electronic. There's a lot more traceability in terms of a claim was filed on a certain day. How long did it take for that claim to be processed? And I think this is something that can scale. It can scale to Kenya. It can scale to Brazil. It can scale to wherever these large animals, whether they be tigers, lions, leopards, jaguars, are causing problems, and yet you need to respond to people to help them.
As you mentioned earlier, working for the Center for Wildlife Studies, which is a conservationist organization, that presumably if there's a single aim holding this thing together, it's that the animals still get to live, that if the people who are losing livestock and crops can be compensated for it, then they won't protect their interests by killing the wildlife.
Absolutely. And the fact that these extremely high densities of people living close to some of the world's most iconic species, if we're serious about saving this, and as animals are getting squeezed into fewer and fewer wild spaces, connectivity between parks get disrupted, there are going to be more interactions as animals come out and, you know, move through landscapes. I mean, some of us who live in cities have no idea how dramatic and terrifying and scary these kind of losses can be for a family.
I was struck by what you said earlier about how you've noticed a much greater tolerance in India than there would be in a lot of other places, especially in Europe, for losses of livestock and crops caused by wild animals. And as someone who grew up in Australia with quite a lot of farmers in the family, I know that they themselves have a fairly low threshold for what they're willing to put up with as well. But where do you sense that tolerance among the Indians you've dealt with comes from. Do they understand the conservationist aspect of this, that that the people you're dealing with also hope that there is a way that wild elephants and tigers can still manage to live in India?
I think part of it is historical. When we've talked to a lot of these people, many of them say these animals have been around as long, if not longer, than all of us, so we need to figure out a way to coexist with them. Part of it is cultural. India, and particularly Hinduism, has a lot of gods that either are animals or ride animals.
Mm.
And so there is a little bit of that as well, I think. So it's a combination of culture, religion, history, and this sort of awareness that these animals belong here as well.
So in India in particular, you feel like there's actually quite a lot of goodwill from the locals to try and find a way to coexist and to make this work. You don't often hear people just saying, no, just wipe them all out, get rid of them. That's the only way to solve the problem.
I do hear it, but it's very, very rare. And I wouldn't even want to lump India into one sort of common path, because different parts of India, there's different levels of tolerance. So I'd say Western India, where people are largely vegetarian, in states like Gujarat and Rajasthan, are amongst the most tolerant parts. Southern India, Central India is sort of in the middle. And then you go to Northeast India, a lot of the animals have been shot and hunted out, right? And so there are sort of three Indias in my own mind in terms of tolerance as well. But broadly speaking, in very general terms, I do think people do appreciate that there are animals that live close to us or with us, right?
I mean, what kind of response, if any, have you had from state and national governments about this? Have they been supportive?
Well, at the ground level, we've had a lot of support from the staff, because the Indian government has significantly invested in conservation, and they do know that their, you know, park rangers are overloaded with the number of challenges they have to deal with, whether it be anti-poaching, controlling deforestation, fires, conflict. So they do realize that by doing this efficiently, we are easing the load on their own staff and definitely improving relationships with communities. But there's been a little bit of tension too, because it has exposed the corruption, the bureaucracies, the inefficiencies, and on a very global scale. And that has had some backlash.
In what kind of ways has that backlash manifested?
Well, in my case, when there was a public voting, I was directly attacked by a government official saying that this project doesn't exist. Kriti Karanth is a fraud. And basically saying that all of the work is being done by them, and we just issued a clarification saying, yes, the compensation and the funding comes from the government, and it has and always will come. What we are trying to do is ease the process, and we've done that for over 15,000 claims as of today.
You mentioned earlier that that attitudes towards wildlife vary quite significantly across India. That being the case, how important a part of your project is education, is changing attitudes where I guess they need to be changed? And I'm thinking specifically of Wild Charlet, which is the part of your program aimed at children. How does that work?
So I think the need for Wild Charlet also arose because we'd done the research and then we had started Wild Save. It had been running 3 years, and I realized we were working with the adults in all of these communities and helping put bandages on every wound that was cut. But all of the kids living in these villages who actually saw elephants, who saw leopards on a regular basis, had either very neutral or very negative reactions to these amazing animals, very different from my own personal life. And I said, to do this long term, you need to start to build that level of interest, empathy for these big animals in the next generation. Because our research also established that older people were the most tolerant, and that tolerance levels were going down further because people were moving to cities and There's less of an interest in agriculture in a lot of these places, and they're not as connected to the land or the animals on the land. And so we felt that it was important to design a conservation education program that was scalable, repeatable, and could reach thousands of kids.
Is that just a question, though, do you think? And I think it's quite a commonplace of people all over the world that whatever you grow up around and whatever you grow up among just seems like your idea of the normal and the everyday. And even if it is something that most of us would find as astonishing as a tiger or an elephant or a leopard, you know, you're just thinking, yeah, big deal.
I think it's very, very common, particularly I see this sort of disconnect between urban and rural Indians. I see it between, you know, urban dwellers worldwide and rural dwellers, right? Because with a lot of people living in cities, because of watching National Geographic, Discovery, Animal Planet, interest in photography, people go, do travel, take vacations to, you know, photograph and look at these amazing animals around the world. So an urban person would very much want to try and save every tiger, every lion, every leopard, but they've never lived with the reality of a leopard on top of your roof trying to get at your goats or your family, right? And so there's that balance of the romanticism of these big animals versus the practicality of trying to live aside them.
When you're conducting the Wild Shala program, practically how does it work? Which kids are you reaching out to, and what is it you're teaching them when you have them?
So it is a program that's focused on middle school children, so 10 to 13 year olds, because we felt that kids younger than that may not be able to process all of this, and kids older may not be as interested. And so we picked middle schoolers, and we are focusing on schools in high-conflict villages adjacent to a bunch of national parks. This program is scaling at a level that I never imagined. In our first year, with support from National Geographic, we went to 50 schools and 2,500 kids. In our second year, we're going to go to 400 schools and reach about 40,000 children by the end of sometime in 2020, which is a massive increase. And what the program does is it's a four-part program. It uses art, it uses storytelling, it uses some presentations and games for kids to understand how we're connected to wildlife, starting with building empathy for animals like tigers and elephants, growing to how we're all part of food webs and what happens when there is ecological collapse and how we are interconnected with wildlife. And with our last session actually focusing on what is conflict, why does conflict happen? If you are in a conflict situation, what are the safety do's and don'ts? Giving them some practical advice as well. It's a program, being scientists, we're evaluating children. We pre and post test each child because we go back to every school once a week. So it's not a one shot. We run the program for total contact time with each child is about 15 hours. So we go to the same school four times in a month and then evaluate the child to see how we've done. Early results are showing that there's been a 100% increase in knowledge. There's been an increase in empathy, but what we're finding is Indian children are inherently way more empathetic than... so the scales that were used in North America don't work as well because you're pushing a child from a 90 to a 95 or a 97, whereas if you, I think, did these empathy scales with a North American or West European child, you could actually go much higher on the empathy scale. So we're trying to figure out how do you test empathy better, how do you measure it better. And it's a wonderful collaboration because we work with artists, we work with storytellers to build a curriculum that's fun and engaging.
When you talk about that difference between, say, Indian and North American kids in terms of their empathy for your larger scale wildlife, is there a way you can express that, I guess, anecdotally away from the numbers? Like, what are you able to get an Indian kid to see in a tiger that you can't quite get an American kid to see in, I don't know, a cougar or a coyote or similar?
So, I mean, we do fun things like, you know, ask them to tell stories and write stories and draw. And at least in the storytelling, you realize that they've heard about these animals through songs and folklore as well. And it's just the kind of words that are used to describe these animals, from being really positive and neutral words to being negative words, as simple as saying, you know, not using the word "the animal attacked me" versus "the animal came," you know. And it's simple tools and techniques to try and get these children to communicate what they feel.
I was also intrigued by what you were saying about practical do's and don'ts in terms of safety. And not that I find it easy to imagine circumstances in which I am going to know this or am going to need to know this, but if there is a leopard on your roof, what do you actually do at that moment?
Don't run out of the house trying to chase it. It's safer to stay indoors and wait for it to go away, right? A lot of people will charge at animals in the hope that making a lot of noise will make them go away, and that doesn't always... I mean, actually, cats are pretty elusive in the sense that they won't attack you first, right? It's probably in response. Whereas trying to do that with an elephant, you could provoke some very devastating consequences if you started to chase them and then they turned around and started to charge at you.
I would think. I wanted to ask about your own way into this, because you're kind of doing the job, as I understand it, that you were raised to do. You come from a line of people with an interest in conservation, your father and your grandfather.
I was not raised to do this. I just grew up around some extraordinary people who cared very much. In my grandfather's case, the environment. In my father's case, wildlife in particular. And personally rebelled against this. So when I started my undergraduate career, did not start in wildlife, but about 2 years in, found that I inevitably loved doing this more than anything else, and so came back to it in my early 20s.
You can only rebel against your parents so much, can't you?
Absolutely. And I think it was also, you know, I'm extraordinarily fortunate to have had exposure to people like my parents and my grandfather, who are deeply committed and passionate about different things that they work on, and leaving an impact on the world, bettering society in some way. And so the bar was set very high, and that can be pretty scary too when you have two parents who have PhDs at home. And so then you have to be a Dr. Current at some point to even level the playing field.
You were talking earlier about how as people move into cities and places where they have slightly less of a chance of having a leopard actually on their roof, therefore start to worry about them a bit more. Do you get the sense that there is something of a leap forward in environmental consciousness in India occurring? Because India's not going to get any smaller. It could be 1.5 billion people by 2050. And that's the kind of growth which can have an extraordinarily detrimental effect very, very quickly on the natural world.
So India is, I think, at the extreme edge of conservation in a lot of different ways. We have less than 5% of land set aside as wild spaces. You put that in contrast to US and China, they have 15% set aside. You look at small countries like Costa Rica, Bhutan, they have 30% set aside. So as an Indian, I can't imagine aspiring to a 15% or a 30% for nature. But I do think there are ways we can get from the 5% to 10% and yet support 1.5 billion people. Because of this emphasis rightfully on improving the human condition, there's also the pull of urbanization, which is beginning to take place. You have millions of people who want to live in cities now, who don't want to be farmers, who don't want to live in rural parts of India. And if you can design cities with the right kind of infrastructure, whether it's sewage, water, housing, all of this, to support these millions of people, you could create that space and create more space for wildlife. So I think we're really at a turning point, because if tolerance and awareness is eroding in rural places but building in urban places, you're going to have that tension between different kinds of people, with urban people pushing for saving wildlife and saving nature, and then rural people saying, we don't really care, we want better lives. And somewhere in there, you're going to have to figure out multiple different ways to manage both.
Is there anything to be said, and this is just something that stuck in my head from somebody I was talking to about similar subjects in South Africa, and their idea was that ultimately the way to preserve the natural environment is to persuade people that it's profitable to do so, that you can actually, that there isn't, not only is there not ultimately an economic cost to preserve the natural environment, it's actually an economic benefit because basically because people will pay money to come and look at it. Is that an important part of how this could improve in India?
I think it's a huge part of it. Wildlife tourism is the obvious one. The revenue generation potential of tourism is enormous. I've done some work on looking at tourism in India, and what we found is 90% of tourism in India around these big tiger parks, around some of the most charismatic places, is Indian, in contrast to a lot of other places in the world where the tourists are usually foreigners. So there's already the momentum in terms of numbers of people willing to pay to come see wildlife. Where the system's not working as well is the trickle-down economics of really getting the profits from tourism to reach all of the people living around these parks rather than being concentrated in private hands where a few resorts actually make the money. And I think Africa has a lot of wonderful examples of community-based tourism, small-scale tourism run by individuals. So it's not these just these large-scale commercial operations. Another idea that we've been sort of talking about for a while is, and that's beginning to pick up globally, is this idea of wildlife-friendly. That products, whether it be, you know, sheep's wool from Argentina or ibis rice from Cambodia or wildlife-friendly coffee from India and South America, you see the consciousness in consumers now where they want to know that whatever they're consuming, using, is ethically sourced from the human side in terms of labor practices. But there's the whole organic movement, which a lot of people now believe in very strongly. And the next step is beyond organic, is really getting people to be conscious about what they buy or eat, and figuring out ways where wildlife things grown in a wildlife-friendly manner can be certified and sold at scale. There's very few examples of this in the world. Ibis rice from Cambodia is one of the most beautiful examples, where, you know, giant ibis is landing in rice fields, and there's a premium paid for the rice growers, and they now, there's this huge movement to support these big birds, right? But if we started to do that, then you're truly creating a sustainable model where people practicing and growing things the right way are incentivized with a higher price for these products.
Well, to go back to the programs you're operating at the moment, how do you see them expanding and developing over the next couple of years?
So there's always, for me, the excitement comes from designing things that are simple but scalable. But as one organization in the world, we can't be everywhere doing everything. What I would like to really nurture is and partner is with other conservation organizations, not just in India, but across the world, where there is a Wild Chale Brazilian version or a Wild Save Kenyan version, because these ideas are not, I mean, the animals change and the landscapes change, but the fundamental problems and solutions are universal. And that, to me, would be the greatest success, actually, just creating and partnering with other people and equipping them and working with them to design similar things in other parts of the world.
The Rolex Awards are, of course, part of the company's Perpetual Planet campaign, which wants to help people like you and those other programs you mentioned join forces. So from where you are now, what does it actually take for your project to scale up further and become more widely applicable in that way?
So for me, actually, Wild Chale is scaling at an incredible pace that I would never imagine, going from 2,500 children to 40,000 children in just a year. And earlier, perhaps, I would have imagined getting to 100,000 kids to be a massive achievement. Now I think, you know, getting to 1 million or 10 million children is very, very doable if we had the right partners and were able to do this. Wild Save is a little I think, more complicated because it is based on a fundamental system that the government pays out compensation. So you would have to figure out a perpetual funding source to make those payments and then develop a system that compensates people efficiently. And it's also one where the problem will never go away. There will be certain parts of the world where large animals and people continue to live next to each other. And once you become part of a community, you can't pull back. Whereas while Charlie can, you know, roll through schools, roll through parks, come back to the same schools 3 years later, you'd have new kids to work with, right? And so the depth and the breadth of the two programs are very different. But I think the impacts will also be very different.
Just finally then, since the Rolex Award was announced, what impact has that had on the project and had on you personally, being a Rolex laureate?
I didn't quite appreciate what an honor this is. I didn't appreciate sort of the depth and the long-term relationship that you have with a company like Rolex. What's very clear to me is that they are invested in individuals. They're not invested in them in just 2019. They will stay with you for life if you can continue to do your good work. For me, in particular, the Wild Chalet program, there's a lot of support from Indian companies now. There is that 2% CSR law, which mandates that companies of a certain size with a certain amount of profit have to give away their funding. And historically, they've supported health and education and very rarely environment-related stuff. And I'm beginning to see that momentum and interest for Indian companies to support this to scale across India, which I think is fabulous.
That was Dr. Kriti Karanth, who's one of Rolex's 2019 laureates. Over the coming weeks on The Pioneers, we'll be meeting more of the innovators whose bright ideas are changing the world we live in, including Emma Camp, whose work with Coral is trying to make it more resilient to human pollution. But until then, thanks for listening.